I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am joined by the incomparable Jim Rawlings. So, Jim, tell me where you're from and how was your childhood?
Fed my way out. You know, I was in Providence. That's where I grew up at. It was called Indian Hill. And my family lives on the reservation. My mom's lives on the res in Mass. And so I went to pharmacy school down there in Rhode Island. And I come to think about it and doing my my biography, I was wondering why I had so many challenges academically. In those days, there was no such thing as a CVS or Walgreens, anything like that. They were all family owned. So I went to U of I to play ball because I had no role models, you know. And I think about those days because I was the only black at the in U of I. In the School of Pharmacy. I got my ass kicked around a lot because I didn't have the experience that family-owned pharmacies have. And when the young people grow up in those pharmacies, they know what elixirs are, pills, all that kind of stuff. I know none of that stuff. My uncle was the second minority out of the College of Pharmacy. But so when the dean pulled me in, he said, "You got to declare something." I said, "What's that mean, declare?" What does that mean, declare? So the dean called my my mother up, and we had a discussion, and I didn't know what declare was. She said, "Your uncle used to be a pharmacist. Why don't you try that?" I said, "Okay, fine. I don't know what the hell a pharmacist was." And so I had a hard time. But if someone tells me I can't do something, I'm going to do it. I learned that early on. And so I survived that part of it. And then 5 to 6 years later, because that's what pharmacy is, 5 years or six, I had moved to the point where we were integrating with the pre-med kids. And so that's when all of a sudden I started understanding, or my understanding was, I was competing with people who had experience, but you don't normally have an experience relative to med students because that's normally the first generation. So I said, I was doing well. I said, "Oh, damn, should I?" You know? And so one of the disappointments was I was working real hard and understood the game. I became number one in the class. And I'm dressed up and all that kind of stuff for graduation. And because number one in the class meant that you were a clinical pharmacist, not a pharmacist, clinical pharmacist. You can go on rounds. You know, the program closed. I said, "Where's my award at?" That's what I was saying to myself. And but it's been like that all my life.
Oh, mm-hmm. So you become a clinical pharmacist, and how did you go about getting your first job? Or did you continue school after that? Or,
well, you know, when I was working at the Hill Health Center, because in those days, the early 70s, the Hill Health Center was born out of the medical school pediatrics. And then it became because they did the grant work, et cetera, et cetera. They had the vision. And so since I was a minority of coming from Providence, got the job offer, took it up here. Scotty was in place. And the rest is history. And then about two or three years into the role, a guy named Isidore Falk. He is the founder of HMOs.
Wow.
He did the first HMO was in Long Wharf. So he saw me doing some things that other pharmacists didn't do, because I knew that I had to protect the patients, not correct the physicians, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was writing everyone up, but just in my own way. So Dr. Falk came by and said, what are you doing? I said, this is, I'm protecting the clients and patients. And, you know, a lot of times you, sometimes you get doctors who are number one in the class, and sometimes you get them number 100. We don't understand that. We don't understand that. A doctor is not a doctor. Because if you're last in the class, you don't want to mind taking care of your family, but we don't know that. Just like lawyers. You know, you can go down to Dixwell Avenue and get a lawyer, or you can go up to New York and get a lawyer. You don't want to be second, number two in a courtroom.
Wow. So you're doing your thing. You're working with when the first HMOs is approaching you.
No. I didn't go into an HMO. Isidore Falk asked me why was I there. And he wanted me to go become a hospital administrator. You know, so I got my master's at Yale, and the rest is history because I was the first minority administrator at Yale New Haven Hospital. And that was tough stuff because they were basically a lot of blue eyes. But those were hard years. But, you know, we don't understand how organizations are, because when you look at a Yale New Haven Hospital or any business, we're at the bottom and those at the top don't look like us. Okay. So I came into the hospital with a, you know, pretty good reputation coming out of Yale. And then I served when I graduated, I went to DC as a fellow. And I was working on the Bureau of Community Health Centers, but I also was working on, what was it? The National Blood Lung Institute, which is where they do all the blood pressure stuff. And working on the U.S. Pharmacopeia. And the U.S. Pharmacopeia in them days was the United States' formulary, drug formulary. So all that happened is going on, you know. So and I meet a lot of smart people. Mm. True man. I became a member of Blacks in Government, which was anyone who was everyone who was a black in that package. They had tremendous leverage. Tremendous. Like this guy who just retired the other day. The guy who saved Biden down in South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Clyburn.
Yep.
Well, them guys, you know. Of course, there's females, Maxine Waters, all that kind of stuff. So that was a good environment. So I came out of that with the perspective that if I was working for 40 hours, which I did in New Haven, which I did in some capacity in Providence, but when I was working at Yale New Haven Hospital, I was working for 40 hours and we had an impact on 3.1 million people, right? So when I was working in DC, working the same 40 hours, what's the impact that I had? Oh, that someone does have in DC? 300 million, same 40 hours.
Wow.
Same 40 hours, you know? And I used to do certain things that move things from shoulds to shalls. And it's powerful down there. You know, so yeah. Then I became more involved with politics, and because New Haven is, if you're not a New Havener born, you know, you ain't no New Havener. That was always the thing. So I rose up behind Roger Van, but the big dog was Heywood Hooks. And when he passed, and then who was it? The big guy in the church, the Reverend, he used to come to the NAACP all the time because politics and all that kind of things. Reverend Edmonds, powerful guy. And so one of his sons was a president of a hospital in D.C. So he took to me, you know. And then as I grew, I became a generalist in the hospitals, because that means you run a lot of departments. It was a good experience, because I apply all those things yesterday and today and tomorrow. Yeah. I built the first sickle cell center in the Yellow Haven Hospital, you know. And I didn't even do that because we had a CEO or CFO that all we had to do is knock on the door, make your case business plan. And, you know, CFO was, then they would say, okay, sign off. Because if the plan was good, it was good. You know, none of the crazy stuff, because it made money. And it made for a kind of visible actions relative to the hospital saying they're doing good.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, and we're listening to the story of Jim Rawlings. I know we jumped ahead to sickle cell and Yale and what you're doing now. Can you talk a little bit about overcoming adversity and overcoming the lack of role model? And that it is possible.
Yeah. You know, I never had a role model per se. I had Cornell Scott, but he hadn't worked in a hospital. But he taught me a lot of the things that I applied, how to build a team, how to get along with your foes and adversaries. You create win-wins. How to manage individuals that have goals and hopes. Those who are marginalized, because that's what this is, that piece of it. And you create win-wins. And you grow by pulling people up. So I've done a lot of mentoring because of the same question you asked me about the success and or the lack of role models, et cetera, et cetera. There weren't any role models at the Yellow Haven Hospital in days, other than some people who wanted to help. But that was tough. I did, when we used to do retreats, you know, a retreat is, mm-hmm. You go away in upstate New York. And every time I think about this, because I'm doing my autobiography, when we went up to, did retreats up in 100 miles away or New York, something like that, I was just as happy as hell to be in a C-suite. But I didn't know what C-suite was. But I did know one thing, that if there were 9 cabins on the campus, I was going to be the furthest one out, and they had no roommate. And all they would do was come together and kind of leave you on the outside, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But then you learn how to say one-on-one's three, because there were good people in this world, that there were some things that I knew I could not say, that I got them the same for me. You know, and I've always done that. I learned that. You don't alienate individuals who want to help you.
Children these days say that they have more obstacles now. But how hard is it to pave the road? I mean, You had no one to your left or to your right. You had some assistance. And at times, bad advice. How did you decipher which what was good, what was bad, and how did you learn that?
I think I learned that by watching others' leaders around me. The same things they would do for their people, I did for my people. It had a cost to it, but a lot of that came individuals who went from acorns to oak trees. Oh. You know?
So you learn how to nurture by watching others.
Oh yeah. The survivors and the winners. There's other terms you can use for that, you just watch and you learn. If you don't learn in an environment, what the hell, why are you there? And when I was a young kid on Bates Street, which was in Providence, I used to, when I went on the res, there was always like a, I think it's like an hour and a half ride. And in them days, you could fish along the way. So I would always take my fish and bring them back to those who are relatively poorer than I was, my family was. And so I've tried to continue that. And I learned that quickly, to look around you and take care of those individuals who you deem to be hungrier than you. Let's use that term.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm. You help develop Career High School.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was that adventure and how did that come about?
Well, it went came about when the vision for Career High School was in place, bricks and mortar. And then the medical school took a liking to it and they offered some courses. So believe it or not, when we started Career High School, it was like 90% African-American Hispanic. Once the medical school got involved, often pathology and things of that nature in labs, you can see how it has evolved and how these individuals who don't need as much as we do took advantage of it. Oh. And so you'll see that algorithm of what it was and what it's like now, you know.
So what was the original intention for Career? Do you see that they have moved away from their mission?
No. When I was at the hospital, I ran most of the school-based clinics. So in the process there, no one had a model for what that school was going to become. It was just name and only, and they hoped to be able to attract, you know, those kind of individuals. But there wasn't really a mission, unless I was out of the loop, because I was building school-based clinics and fighting with physicians and providers that didn't want their clients be working, have the advantage of having a second opinion. Hmm. And that was it. And the more, the wealthier the suburbs were, the more challenging it became, because they were dead set against anything like that. They were all set for poor kids, but you know, yeah, you bring up some of the things that, some of those battles.
Battles, never easy, never smooth. Can we talk about one of your biggest victories coming up in your career? A moment that really sticks out for you?
It's when I knew I what could be competitive at a cerebral level. But when Isidore Falk said something like Yale was number five in the country, you know? And I got into Yale. And so what I did is that I knew the pathway I had taken, but I wanted everyone else in the class of color to be successful. Because when the first year, we probably had 10 there. And about two or three out of the 10 didn't do well academically. And so I saw that as a reason why they wouldn't grow the classes. So we stuck together, you know. So I took it upon myself to make sure everybody was doing well and partnering for the success that we wanted for the next generation.
Wow. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. Jim Rawlings sharing his story. Now the fight for sickle cell. You got stats upon stats upon stats.
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear the stats about the youth. Youth and how the sickle cell is affecting our students.
I've had the most difficult time as a challenge with the school systems in our big three major areas, because Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven, they're 30% of the population. And I've tried to get data. I have national data because I'm a data person. And I had some data from individuals who are in my network. But when I approach the system, I cannot replicate the data that I have nationally. And I know through my experience that the same data in the same environment exist in Mississippi and LA, et cetera, et cetera. California and Chicago are the two largest districts in the country, school districts, besides New York. Pardon my brush up on that one. but when I, and I brought this here because I wanted to be able to show you that this was the first profile of sickle cell disease in the country. It's all data driven.
And what year is this from?
It's all footnoted here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
There you go. Yep.
Because you can't kill a messenger. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm getting ready to update that chart.
So this is as of 2013. Mm-hmm. 1 in 10 African American babies are born with sickle cell.
With sickle cell anemia.
Trait.
Right.
Well, 2.5 million Americans carry the sickle cell trait.
Right.
1 in 25 Hispanics mm-hmm. are born with the sickle cell trait.
Mm-hmm. That's just national level.
That's just national.
That's right. But that whole thing holds true as you move from state to regions to towns. Okay? It's called an algorithm.
The algorithm. And here you're saying now in Connecticut, a person with sickle cell is hospitalized on average 5.6 times a year. So if you're a student,
mm-hmm.
isn't that most of your academic years?
It is. Our students average 25 days per year in hospitals.
How can you graduate then if you miss that much time? You're only allowed 11 to 15. That is the fight that you...
That's my challenge. That's our challenge.
And then admission from sickle cell now has increased 24%.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of awareness and now people being more educated and also...
Yeah, you know, the most recent palliative care, you know, palliative care, just when you have pain medications,
mm-hmm.
Has done a lot for the crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no cure. But quite often, as an adult, you're on that opioids. And so that helps you to some extent. But in 1970, I think most people didn't live to live beyond 21. Now they live beyond, I think it's 39. Mm. The challenge we have is in these numbers here. This number, for example, here, 40,000, right? You know what that number is now? 65,000.
In the state of Connecticut.
With anemia, carriers.
Carriers here in Connecticut, 65,000. So it is increasingly evident in our Black and brown communities predominantly.
Yeah, because, you know, if you look at the birth rates, you know, you can just see that. You know, we continue to, you know, to go forth, and whereas others are averaging one to two kids, you know, that kind of stuff.
So there's a disparity of this affecting people of color versus people of non-color?
Yeah, there's no question. The continent of Africa, they have a significant issue with malaria. So what's happened is that there's resistance to, when you have sickle cell anemia, you automatically have resistance to malaria. It's a genetic change. So that's why this number here, when they come, like for example, I have it's indigenous to Nigeria, okay? So they're not part of the solution because it's indigenous to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's probably a 20 or 30, what's it called? Infant mortality rate, mm-hmm. All right? And I have a student who's a double E major at Southern, and who I'm mentoring, even though he wants to go his way. I want him to go public health. He didn't even know the fact what the numbers were. Mm-hmm. I asked him some numbers that, you know, he was born in Nigeria and he's 23 years old and things of that nature. But when you talk to individuals who are in a endemic mm-hmm. Country, mm-hmm. it's part of living.
Wow. It's just, they're immune to it. They're desensitized to it.
That's right. Because it's just, you know.
Because it's just common.
It's just common.
So is now you're bringing attention towards sickle cell, mm-hmm. and you have now a program at Yale?
No, I try to keep myself away from Yale.
Okay.
I try to be, we're a health program.
Okay.
Yale is a medical facility. So what we try to do is to prevent the expansion of sickle cell disease by addressing these individuals here, because it's a genetic disease. Mm-hmm. And you know as well as I do that if a Black or Hispanic person, male, is weak, they're not respected in the community. Mm. You know that, walking down streets.
Yep.
And so I always think about the idea that of the slavery. If you were born with sickle cell disease, my hypothesis is that you are of no value to the master. Mm. So they just killed you. Mm-hmm. Or they did something other than that, but you were just property. So as a male,
but now we're in the age of technology, and you believe that even though you have sickle cell, you still can contribute to your society and your family.
Oh, there's no question. We've done more in 5 years, because I have a long table, like the length of this room. And I'm always wondering why we haven't come together around sickle cell disease. And we have more enemies because we have to follow the money. So anyone who benefits from it I have to second guess them. But we have more distractors than we have supporters. Because you got to understand following the money.
Here you have also now how sickle cell compares to other social justice issues. Mm-hmm. 60% of sickle cell patients rely on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Sickle cell receives 11 times less funding per individual than some other rare genetic disease. 40% of sickle cell youth repeat a grade. We were talking about earlier because when you have sickle cell and you go through an episode, it takes, you say, 25 days?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah.
On average?
Yeah. Well, they're in hospitals, 25 days. That could be five admissions or it could be one, but the average is 25 days.
Wow.
Within a year.
And then 60% of sickle cell youth report having sickle cell disease interfering with their education, of course, because it's not steady and it's hard. And this is the most prevalent rare genetic disease in the world.
That's right.
Why do you feel like it does not get the attention it deserves?
Black and brown. Black and brown. And we don't understand that there are groups that benefit off of research and things of that nature. And let's take, for example, the school system. There are probably 20,000 kids, children, in each of the three big school systems. And they're basically impoverished urban areas. Well, I understand why they can't do something because of funding. They're too stretched. But on the other hand, the sickle cell community, it's just, those numbers are the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I can't, and I've met with a lot of superintendents, and they're just, they won't give the data. I have the data, mm-hmm. you know, because I have friends and things of that nature. And sometimes we do, what do you call those things? The things that you do, documentaries. Mm-hmm. and the kids, when the kids are quiet, but once we say school system, they're doing 360s. We're going down to NASA because of STEM.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so this is what we're doing to have them understand that if you don't have any aspirations, if you're without aspirations because you've been beaten down, I want to... And normally we go to the Smithsonian.
Let me read off. Mm-hmm. Michelle's House Sickle Cell Disease Association of America. They have a NASA Goddard Space Center visit. This is happening March 29th with pickup locations in New London, New Haven, Fairfield County. Scholarships are available. 40 for adults, $20 for children. No children under 10 of age. And payments are due by March 4th. And then this is through your website or what's the contact information?
Oh, this is just cut off. I can give you the contact information.
Okay.
If you go to the website, you'll see it there.
Okay. What's the website name?
I think it's called Michelle's House.
Oh, Michelle's House. Okay. Very good. we'll get that on there.
No, I just do this out of from the top of a, you know, yeah.
We're wrapping up here.
Mm-hmm.
You are very passionate about this. Mm. This has become your mission. I can see it. I can sense it in your soul. What are the goals you want to strive to achieve?
I want to drive awareness. For some reason, and I know the reason why not, don't have males engaged in the health prevention side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Females are engaged in the healthcare system, in the medical system. But when we do events, if they're not giveaways, we have just failed at getting males involved Because it takes a male and a female to have a baby.
Mm-hmm. So awareness amongst males, because males predominantly carry the gene, or they pass on the gene?
No, they don't. There's one for one.
Okay.
But males are not engaged. So they're not going to say to someone, for a lot of different reasons, either they haven't been screened, or they don't know when they're screened because they forgot, you know, they're in poverty and shooting all that stuff up. And I'm running data right now that I have some healthcare data from all the hospitals in the state that in aggregate, we know that it's 39 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
But we in the minority community know there's a delta between the life expectancy of a female and a male.
Mm.
Yeah, it says 39.
So awareness for men of color, brown?
No, for males.
Males.
All right. But Latinos and the Latino male and the African-American male, they are equally exposed to wanting not to know that on the streets, you can't be weak. You're taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
The same groups, are not involved in relationships,
mm-hmm.
because they can't have a relationship that's long term. Because once the female finds out, she'll know that this is a brother, okay, who. If he doesn't tell me, or they don't share it, the family live a life of shame.
So you're encouraging males of color,
oh, yeah.
to go and screen themselves, see their doctors,
mm-hmm.
Try to get Medicaid. There's no excuse now to not have medical.
That's right.
To not go out there and screen yourself for sickle cell. So we can go ahead and you say that there's treatment now, or
well,
how has
new
that changed?
There's new treatments because of CRISPR, the genetic DNA and RNA. There's a new new therapies out there. I am hopeful that, and I had a Black History Month celebration of just the new therapies at Michelle's house, where I had the two doctors, leading doctors at UConn and at the Yellow Haven Hospital. And the new pediatrician at the Smiler Center, because all these programs are under oncology, hematology. But I'm hopeful, because I've been at this quite a while. And I don't mean I've been at this quite a while. You know, I was doing things in the NAACP that wouldn't even be done before. But I can't believe why this has lasted so damn long, and there's been smart men and smart females. And so the issue to me that's come to me is that you got to follow the money.
Last words.
Mm-hmm.
We have to say goodbye, and mm-hmm. I appreciate your time.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness. Get yourself tested.
Yep. Yep.
Get involved.
Oh, yes. And love your community. Don't abandon it.
Mr. Rawlings, thank you very much for your time. Mm. You are a very busy man, as we can all hear. Time is of the essence. I thank you very much for coming by. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. And again, thank you for your listen.
Thank you. Thank you for the time. Yeah.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.